Thank you for downloading this Council on Foreign Relations podcast. CFR is an independent national membership organization and nonpartisan research center. For more information, please visit us online at cfr.org.
Good afternoon from New York, and welcome to the CFR Academic Conference Call Series. I'm Irina Faskanis, Vice President for the National Program and Outreach here at CFR. Today's call is on the record, and the audio will be available on our website, cfr.org. We're delighted to have Micah Zenko and Sarah Krebs with us to discuss the implications of drones on U.S. foreign policy. Dr. Zenko is CFR's Douglas Dillon Fellow in the Center for Preventive Action. Prior to coming to CFR, he worked for 5 years at the Harvard Kennedy School and in D.C. at the Brookings Institution, Congressional Research Service, and State Department's Office of Policy Planning. Dr. Zenko writes the blog Politics, Power, and Preventive Action, which you can find on CFR.org, and there he covers U.S. national security policy, international security, and conflict prevention, and you can also follow him on Twitter at Micah Zenko. Dr. Krebs is Associate Professor of Government at Cornell University, where she is also co-director of the Cornell Law School International Law and International Relations Colloquium, and an affiliate of the Foreign Policy Initiative at the Center for International Studies. Her research focuses on issues of international security, including questions of conflict and cooperation, alliance politics, political economy, and nuclear proliferation. And last year, she spent the year here at the Council on Foreign Relations as an International Affairs Fellow, so we were happy to have her here in New York. While she was here, she and Dr. Zenko co-authored a council special report entitled Limiting Armed Drone Proliferation that we released in June. We sent that out in advance of this call. So welcome, Micah and Sarah. Thank you very much for being with us today. Micah, let's start with you. If you could give us an overview of how drones are being used and why U.S. practice matters.
Hi. Thank you so much for the opportunity, Irina, and it's great to talk over the phone with everybody and look forward to some of the questions that I'm sure you'll have that ask what you're interested in later on. But just a few points before we get there. It's important to understand that what we talk about in this report is limited and scoped in a way that is narrow, which is we're interested in the use of primarily armed drones. These are drones that are capable of launching weapons, and we're interested primarily in how they're being used outside of battlefields, which is the most controversial aspect for their use. So we're not drilling down on the use of small surveillance drones that are used in battlefield situations, and we're also not drilling down specifically on the use of even armed drones in declared known battlefields, but we're interested in where the issues of law and precedents and norms are more unsettled and more controversial. And so some of the things to really understand about the U.S. precedents for drone use is that this is a capability used and developed starting in 1999 just for one individual, which was to go after Osama bin Laden. The CIA and the Air Force had a pretty much of a crash program to arm a surveillance predator drone by putting an anti-tank helicopter missile on it, and by 9/11 this capability sort of exists. Now, it's interesting because at the time, this was still, even after 9/11, this was still seen as a really boutique and discrete option to go after senior members of Al-Qaeda. As you know, soon after 9/11, there's the authorizations for using force, and the CIA gets its own sort of drone capabilities, and drone strikes outside of battlefield start in November 2002. And just last week, quite interestingly, the U.S. Conducted its 500th non-battlefield drone strike. So what began as a really small, narrowly focused capability to go after, again, senior members of Al-Qaeda and initially Osama bin Laden has spread to a much larger degree. Now the U.S. has used these in Pakistan, Yemen, Somalia, the Philippines, and an estimated 3,600 people have been killed by this. And no longer just senior members of Al-Qaeda, but really more low-level militants on behalf of a range of different missions. So what was conceived of as a small capability in the U.S. arsenal, counterterrorism arsenal, grew significantly. And why did this happen? Well, drones have inherent advantages over all other weapons platforms. They can persist over targets for far longer time period to collect information. Just even fully loaded Reaper drones, the newest ones are somewhere between 14 and 20 hours. An F-16 can't do more than 4 or 6 hours, and even there you need some in-air refueling. They're just much more responsive, which is that these drones are several thousand feet above the ground, so you really can track somebody in real time and try to target them. Cruise missiles, as the U.S. tried to kill bin Laden in 1998, they were flown out of Navy ships in the Arabian Sea into southern Afghanistan. They needed to know where bin Laden would be in 4 hours. So the capability really went from 4 hours to as little as 4 to 10 seconds, roughly. And that makes a huge difference. And the final point, obviously, is these don't put U.S. pilots at risk. And subsequently, U.S. civilian policymakers, who ultimately authorized the use of non-battlefield drone strikes, significantly lowered the threshold for when they will authorize force. And just to give you the one example, the U.S. has conducted 390 drone strikes in Pakistan since those missions started. They started in the summer of 2004. So over the last 10 years, there's been 390 drone strikes in Pakistan. The same time period, there's been something like 5 special operations raids. These are manned raids into Pakistan, including the raid in April 2011 to kill Osama bin Laden. And so the point is, this gives you a capability to kill people that did not previously exist, and it changes how civilians conceive of using force. And so how might this be troubling, or how might this capability be received when other countries have this capability? I mean, right now, the only countries who have known to conduct drone strikes are the United States, the United Kingdom, and Israel. Several other countries are believed to be on the precipice of having this capability. Other countries like to claim they do, but it's hard to believe they do. So three things to sort of consider, which is, one, as I mentioned before, armed drones make the use of force more likely. It also probably makes it more precise. But there is this sort of moral hazard, which is because it's more precise, you're going to be more likely to authorize the use of force. The second thing is that one of the things that we sort of learned in our research is that states are more likely to use force against drones than they will against manned platforms. So, for example, if you know anything about the Russia-Georgia war in 2008, before the outbreak of actual conflict, there was a really sort of quiet counter-drone war between Russia and Georgia that escalated into the full outbreak of conflict. Similarly, in the Persian Gulf, the government of Iran routinely tries to shoot down U.S. Predator drones. They try to jam and hack their satellite communications link. They don't try to do this against U.S. manned aircraft. And the reason is they perceive drones as more disposable. They believe that they can get away with harassing U.S. capabilities in the Gulf in a way that they would not get away with against manned platforms. So what this means is there's greater possibility for misperception, miscalculation, and the escalation of force between other countries. And so as you just conceive of, and I'll just end with this point, as you conceive of all the countries in the world that have disputed maritime and ground boundaries, that have disagreements between each other. If you think about states that routinely use military force outside of their border, like, for example, Turkey into Iraq, or the United States, or Israel into Egypt, or into Sudan, or into the occupied territories, or even China, Japan, potentially in the East China Sea, you can imagine a lot of scenarios where armed drones might make the outbreak of conflict between two states much more likely. And so that's part of the intellectual framework that we developed as we thought about how the U.S. can be a responsible user and proliferator of this capability. So I think with that, I'll turn it over to Sarah.
Thanks, Micah. What I wanted to pick up with is the question of how this past that Dr. Zenko has talked about affects prologue in terms of proliferation. And so when we were doing our research on U.S. drone practices, there were two big policy questions that were really simmering, and one was about kind of the arms race, if you will, in terms of other countries pursuing this technology, and that was the demand side. And the other side was the supply side. The U.S. was going through an interagency review about what its export policies on this technology should be. And so this was something that we were giving a lot of thought to. It's not surprising that other countries want this technology. It gives them an ability, like the U.S. has had, to conduct military strikes without incurring meaningful risk. And so the question we were looking at is whether there should be a more liberal set of policies. And the reason that supply-side interagency review process had come up was because of, you know, in this era of declining defense budgets at home, the prospect of selling more armed drones abroad looked increasingly attractive as a way to prop up the U.S. industrial base. And so if other countries were going to acquire that technology anyway, the argument goes, it makes more sense for the U.S. to be the one to export it. And so what we were looking at is what that should look like, and what we suggested is that the answer to this question of whether we should have a more, expansive liberal export policy depends on the answers to three questions. The first one is whether drones are qualitatively different from other platforms, and is this technology destabilizing? And I think Micah did a really thorough job of explaining that, yes, they are different, and yes, those differences are destabilizing. So I don't want to focus so much on that because he has, I think, been quite thorough in that. So what I wanted to focus on are the second two questions. Is drone proliferation inevitable? And third, what are the existing policies in place to deal with proliferation? So the second question, if drone proliferation is inevitable, because if it is, then it makes little sense to worry about whether U.S. policy is stringent or liberal, since these technologies are going to diffuse seamlessly anyway. And what we covered in our foreign policy piece last year is that this is actually not a seamlessly diffusing technology. And there are a couple reasons, things that we point to. One is the experiences a number of other countries have had, advanced industrialized wealthy countries like in Europe, France, Italy, Germany, Russia. All of these countries have been trying to acquire this indigenously, this same advanced armed drone technology, and have been unable to do so. So the inferences that we draw are that if these advanced industrialized countries are struggling to develop this technology, it's unlikely that less wealthy advanced countries are going to fare any better. And so as a result, as Micah mentioned, only Israel, the U.S., and the U.K. have this technology and have used it in combat. What we understand is that China and maybe Iran have indigenously produced advanced armed drones. But what we want to suggest is that this isn't a story of rampant armed drone proliferation. And what it seems to be more like is the analogy of President Kennedy's prediction in 1960 that by the end of the decade, 20 to 25 states would have nuclear weapons. But a concerted effort helped stem that flow, and I think what we would see is that U.S. efforts sort of analogous to this NPT stemming the flow, the Non-Proliferation Treaty, in the context of nuclear weapons, is that concerted efforts can help stem that tide, that it's not a rampant diffusion. For example, recently Israel announced that it was pausing on the sale of UAVs to Russia because of pressure from the U.S. And that gets us to the third point of what is the status of the non-proliferation norm when it comes to armed drones? And is that current system designed in ways that will help address this diffusion? And currently, the missile technology control regime is what regulates the transfer of armed drones. And this was established in 1987, intended to restrict the spread of nuclear weapons delivery systems. But drones were really a bolt-on to that. And as a result, it's clear that that regime that was intended to address nuclear weapons delivery system is not necessarily well suited to armed drones. Not only is it a non-legally binding agreement, it includes it excludes essentially all of the countries that we might worry about producing and exporting armed drones: China, India, Iran, Israel. But I think as problematic as that are the features of the regime that deal with drone exports. So the MTCR was intended for these nuclear delivery systems, so the thresholds are really arbitrary when it comes to drones. So they're Category 1 systems that exceed a range of 300 kilometers and a payload of 500 kilograms, but already industry is coming up with lighter technology that comes under those thresholds that make it possible and quite doable to export these technologies. So what we suggest is that the regime really needs to be bolstered, and in fact some of our colleagues, such as Robert Cohen at Princeton, have gone beyond our suggestions and actually suggested we have a drone-specific international institution. And the last thing that we point to in terms of thinking about ways to stem this diffusion of armed drone technology is it kind of brings us full circle back to what Micah had talked about. There are two, when we think about international law, it's based on both what's on treaty law, which in this case is the MTCR, but also customary law, which in this case is U.S. practice. And so what we suggest is that it's a matter of both strengthening the MTCR, but also the U.S. having more transparency in terms of its targeting decisions. For example, it says that it has a preference of capture versus kill, but it will only use force when other countries are unwilling or unable, or that it is an imminent threat. But the U.S. has been very vague in terms of what it means by unwilling or unable or imminent threat. So we suggest that there needs to be more clarity on these policies to set the terms by which other states that do acquire armed drones think that they should ultimately use them. So I'll just close with those comments and look forward to hearing questions.
Terrific. Thank you both. Let's open up to students on the call for their questions.
Thank you. At this time, we will open the floor for questions. If you would like to ask a question, please press the star key followed by the one key on your touch-tone phone now. Questions will be taken in the order in which they are received. If at any time you would like to remove yourself from the questioning queue, please press star 2. Again, to ask a question, please press star 1. Our first question comes from the University of Pennsylvania.
I have three.
Bill, go ahead. Yeah.
How would the concerted effort to create an international regime that limits the exportation of drone technology, how would that necessarily work? Because you have, nuclear technology is different from drone technology. It's far easier to proliferate drone technology than with nuclear technology. So I'm not sure if that's a fair comparison to create the same kind of international regime. How do you get states that find it much easier to create drones to follow the same international regime to limit the exploitation of the technology and keep it really in the hands of only a handful of states?
So I guess I'll address that since I had talked about this regime. I mean, certainly these are different, and I think that is in part what makes this problematic, is to be subsuming an armed drone regime under a nuclear proliferation regime, because I do think that they're somewhat different. And right now, the arrangement is both it's normative and I think it's self-interest. The norm is that there are these Category 1 systems, and these are basically the advanced armed drones that you think of in terms of a Reaper or a Predator. And the U.S. has generally abided by this and only exported to the U.K. And even, despite the fact that the U.S. has gotten a number of requests from countries like France and others in Europe, among others, the UAE, and so there's the normative one, which is in order to keep that system such as it is functional, it needs to set a precedent in which it's not exporting these Category 1 systems. I think the other one of the other reasons, other than this, the MTCR, that the U.S. has not gone about exporting more of these is one of self-interest. The U.S. doesn't want to be in a position where it's coming into contact with these technologies. It's sort of your standard realist formulation. Today's friend could be tomorrow's foe. I think what it wants to do is keep a closer handle on these technologies so that they don't, when they engage in various parts of the world militarily, don't come into contact with these. Does that, I don't know if that answers your question.
Just one other element. Because nuclear technology requires certain materials like uranium, plutonium to create, it's a little bit easier to kind of, I guess, have kind of a big brother, if you will, over where those materials go, and we do have structures for that. But for the creation of drone technology, actual drone planes, I mean, we've seen China be able to pretty much replicate, not to the same level of quality, I don't think, but we've seen China be able to replicate a lot of our own designs and drones rather quickly, and they're not necessarily, I guess, in our ballpark of nations working with us necessarily on that particular front. So I'm wondering, still, like, even if we have this regime, nations will want to defend themselves, and nations that don't necessarily see eye to eye with the United States will want to defend themselves. And because it's easier to get this kind of technology, I just feel like it's a little bit harder to have a regime where everyone abides, because nuclear technology is so different and requires so many different kinds of materials, where drone technology, the barriers to entry is just so much lower. So I don't know if you, maybe you can speak to that a little bit more.
Can I add?
Go ahead.
Well, I just want to add one quick point, is that as a matter of practice, two-thirds of the global drone market is controlled by two countries, the United States and Israel. And of those two countries, it's really only five manufacturers. China, you're right, has claimed to have replicated some U.S. capabilities, and if you looked at how many they've exported, it's close to zero. And it's the same reason they export almost none of their advanced fighter aircraft, except to close allies like Pakistan and Burma. And the reason is people don't want to buy Chinese weapon systems. Part of the purchase is the enduring relationship that you get with the manufacturer, which is not just the one-off buy and then you have it to defend yourself. Countries want to have long-term relationships with the top-tier manufacturers, in particular the United States and Israel. And so that is not going to change very quickly, but you're absolutely right that the barriers to entry are much lower. But what the barriers allow you to do are not to do the sorts of missions the U.S. does or that Israel does, because obviously, as you know, the United States only conducts transcontinental drone strikes because it has a infrastructure of communication satellites, of host nation basing rights where we fly these operations out of. We have relationships with the governments that allow us to retrieve drones when they crash, for example, and other states won't have that capability. So I think it's been harder. It has proven to be much harder for countries to become armed drone capable than most people think. And one of the things I've done is if you look at when ministries of defense claim that they will have armed drones, they never make their deadline, ever. And at the Farnborough Air Show, which is the big annual air show in England last year, France and the U.K., their latest estimate for when they will co-develop a medium-altitude, long-endurance armed drone is 2030. And they used to claim they'd have this capability in 2012. Well, they haven't. So I think you're right, the barriers are lower, but it's not as low as people think.
Thank you. Next question.
Thank you. Our next question comes from the University of Richmond.
Thank you both for joining us. I'm wondering about the potential for proliferation, not necessarily indigenous development, but the weapons themselves to non-state actors. There were reports a while back that Hezbollah was thought to have fielded the drone, whether it was stolen or copied or whatever. And I wonder if this is something that you think we're going to see more of in the near future.
Let me just take that quickly. It is undoubtedly the case that non-state actors, just as hobbyists and people who have an abiding interest in and fascination with aeronautics, will have the ability to use drones for a range of purposes, the vast majority of which will be to collect information across the spectrum. They'll do surveillance. I mean, you can open up. There's about 25 articles every day that describe some new thing that the drone can do to help civilian, environmental, engineering, meteorological purposes. So that will always be the case, and non-state actors will be able to use these both to spy on their adversaries and potentially to crash them into capabilities. But, you know, the Hezbollah thing is right. Hezbollah has had drones for something like 5 years, but they're relatively, well, they are, they're extremely crude. The other thing that Hezbollah has is they have an estimated, according to the latest Israeli estimates, 60,000 missiles and rockets, which are far more likely to cause harm to Israel or to anyone they pick a fight with. So I think drones enable you to do some additional missions with those drones and rockets and other capabilities. Like if you can identify patrols of IDF forces in northern Israel, you can better target and aim the capabilities you have. But the drone itself, in the near term, they just don't have the power-to-weight ratio to carry much munition. Although, as you know, one of the things we note in our report, these are really good for using for some weapons of mass destruction, particularly if you can get them close enough for some biological and chemical dispersion dispersal, because you don't that doesn't weigh very much. But I'm less worried in the near term about non-state actors getting these to crash them into buildings or individuals, because they have so many other ways to kill people presently, which they're actually really, really, really good at.
Mm. Right, and I think we saw something quite similar earlier this summer with Hamas, when there was this big reveal of, oh, Hamas now has armed drones, but it was clear that these were not only not capable, but they as Micah was suggesting, quickly reverted to the rockets. They were much more effective.
Thank you. Next question.
Thank you. The next question comes from Monterey Institute for International Studies.
Can I press this?
Go ahead.
Your line's
Hi,
open.
Good morning. Good morning. My name is Ayla Ashford. Thank you for taking the time to speak to us about the proliferation of armed drones. I have a question that probably has two sub-questions as well. First off, are there any organizations that are being created or that are already created conducting visits to states such as, you know, the IAEA, BWC, CWC, that will ensure that drones are not being utilized as delivery systems for nuclear chemical weapons? If so, can you elaborate their status and effectiveness? And if not, how will the international system approach this in regards to the left and right limits, ensuring that they're not violating a state sovereignty and airspace?
Should I take this one, Micah?
Yeah.
So I think at this point, you know, I think there's a recognition that the current this current regime is not doesn't have the capacity necessarily to deal with these emerging questions and emerging technologies, and I think that's where you're getting these proposals for things like the drone accountability regime that would deal not just with the technology, and that's not something that we've really talked about so far, this distinction between the technology and the practice. We tend to conflate these, whether it's because you'll read about these movements to ban the drone, and I think what those often do is conflate the technology with targeted killings. And as we have suggested elsewhere, it's hard to disentangle these for some of the reasons that Micah has said, is that because they create this moral hazard, you're more likely to use the technology in the service of targeted killings than you would if it were a manned aircraft. But in some ways, in terms of these prohibitions, it's worth thinking about them also separately, the technology versus the practice of the targeted killings. But so far, it's the responsibility or the way in which these have been used, I think, has been more addressed through NGOs like Amnesty and Human Rights Watch and a number of other reports like the Stanford Law NYU group Living Under Drones, where they have tried to hold the U.S. accountable for violations of sovereignty or collateral damage. And then through groups like the UN Rapporteurs for Targeted Killings that also issue these reports and try to
adjudicate whether the U.S. assertions about casualties are in fact accurate when you go in after and actually interview and see who these individuals are. And so I think it's been those two groups, the NGOs and IOs, to this point, that in their various capacities have tried to address this issue. But again, I think there are probably valid reasons to think that something more specific like a drone accountability regime might be warranted.
And I would just add one point, which is that drones do not revolutionize the international system, right? The principles of sovereignty still apply. And I always tell people to go back and look at, it's actually Article 8 of the 1944 Chicago Convention on International Civil Aviation. The Article 8 of that convention mentions specifically drones that are capable of being flown without a pilot still require the authorization of a sovereign state to fly over them, right? So even though it makes it more likely and you can do it at lower risk to yourself, you still have to get approval to fly these. Now, the U.S. argument is that it receives either express or implicit permission from every state that has conducted drone strikes. Now, we know this is true in the case of Yemen because the head of the government has said he approves them. We know this is true in the case of Somalia because the head of the government has said he approves them. In the case of Pakistan, it's much more difficult because since 2006, the head of the government has said they don't approve of drone strikes, and the parliament has repeatedly said as much. But we know quietly that the government of Pakistan not only, or at least the army of Pakistan, approves of drone strikes. When U.S. drones crash, they actually retrieve them on behalf of the CIA. So we know they do. And the final point I'll make on this is that it is U.S. policy, though, and this is where, as some of the points Sarah mentioned are very tricky, it is U.S. policy that the U.S. reserves the right to intervene in any country in the world where the, quote, relevant governmental authorities are unable or unwilling to deal with a threat to the U.S. So the U.S. claims that it gets permission from every government to fly drones over their sovereign territory, but it does not say it requires it.
Thank you. Next question.
Thank you. Again, if you would like to ask a question, please press star and then the number one. Our next question comes from the Naval Postgraduate School.
Yes, good morning, Sarah and Micah. This is Bradley Strasser out of the Naval Postgraduate School. Thank you so much for joining us this morning. I appreciate the fact that drones are a disruptive technology in foreign relations. I'm not convinced that we necessarily have a strong moral argument to limit their proliferation. I think that's an assumption in the conversation this morning. The reason for that is because they appear to be, as you both pointed out, a moral improvement in terms of the technology itself, other weapons of war, both in the fact that they limit human risk of the pilots themselves, and that they seem to be, the best evidence we have suggests that they're much more precise and they limit collateral damage when compared to other uses of force. Now, you're right that they lower the threshold for the use of force by the states that have them. They might be tempted to use them because precisely they don't have the risk at play. And they also seem to lower the threshold in response to them. Like you pointed out, Iran targeting drones and trying to fight after drones, which perhaps they would not do against manned weapons. But perhaps those are both good things. Perhaps those are, strangely, moral improvements, right? If there are cases when we think use of force is justified, then it seems it's only right to use the best, most precise weapon we have that can most limit our risk. And alternatively, it seems right that it should be a lower threshold to shoot down a drone than it should be to shoot down a manned aircraft. Now, it's true that this, of course, could then lead to escalation, but I think we actually have a moral hazard the other way. I agree that we have a moral hazard in that way, but we also could have a moral hazard the other way, which is that if we intentionally limit the proliferation of drones, then states might end up using force with greater force, with more risky means, or maybe more means causing more collateral damage precisely because they don't have access to drones, when if they had access to drones, they would have used a much smaller weapon of war, they would have caused less damage, and maybe it wouldn't have escalated. So it seems to me that the moral hazard runs both directions here. And if, on par, the weapon itself is a moral improvement in the way that it can limit harm to human beings, then it seems like maybe we shouldn't be so against proliferation.
These are all these are great points and certainly part of the tensions that have, believe me, have fed the ongoing interagency review that the White House was supposed to have been finished last spring, and they're still not done with in terms of what U.S. export policy will be. But I'll just make a couple points is that you make an assumption that there is a certain amount of force you have to use. And this is certainly something the Obama administration likes to say, which is, well, we could put 180,000 troops into a country, which was the height of the 2008 Iraq U.S. force contribution, or we could be doing drone strikes. So if you assume that force is required, absolutely. Drones are much more necessary. But I think, again, I'm old enough to go back to when this capability was first introduced, which was it was intended just for this small tactical discrete use. And the problem is, as I always say, there's a great line, Mike Morrell, who was when he left, he was the acting director of the CIA. He has a book coming out, and he was in the CIA for 30-plus years, and he described it to me, he goes, for every 10,000 hours we spent trying to find somebody with a drone, we spent 10 minutes trying to think about to prevent someone from becoming a terrorist. So the capability has driven and has been at the forefront of civilian policymakers' minds. It changes, I always say, the biggest change that armed drones have made in U.S. foreign policy is between the ears of civilian policymakers. What was supposed to be a small, limited thing has become largely the face of U.S. foreign policy in countries like Pakistan and Yemen, I think to our detriment because, as you point out, these are, when the intelligence is correct, is a much more precise type of weapon. So, I generally agree that tension exists on both sides of things. But the last point I'll make is that there are certain states who are not precise with the use of weapons. And they're going to be not precise with the use of weapons when they have drones. And a great example of this, for example, is Turkey. Turkey uses F-16s. They go into northern Iraq, and they just wipe out a suspected PKK terrorist villages. I don't necessarily believe that they're going to use drones much more precisely because they are much more comfortable with being much less discriminate and causing more collateral damage. And they will also have lowered the threshold for using force. Rwanda into DRC, similar, they're very happy using force relatively indiscriminately. They may do it much more likely with armed drones as well. But I agree, that is the correct tension that you've identified.
I think Micah has covered it well. I appreciate the question. I would just add that I think about this in terms of this is how I've written about it elsewhere, the use ad bellum question and the use in bello question. So when we resort to force and how we use force once we're engaged in conflict. And I think that distinction helps clarify why Micah cites the 500 non-battlefield strikes, because I think most people don't really have a problem with the way drones are being used in Afghanistan. And the worry about proliferation is not so much in those contexts, Afghanistan or active conflict zones, it's that lowering of the threshold, that use ad bellum question, whether states are going to be using force that they wouldn't have used otherwise because now they don't have a skin in the game that they did were they to be using the 180,000 soldiers or the manned aircraft. I think at the outset, several years ago when I first started writing about this, I was much more concerned about that use in bello question and proportionality and distinction. I actually am more comfortable with that than I had been, and I think in part because the U.S. government has taken more measures, as Micah said, these thousands of hours that we stare at the screens, ensuring that the people that we think they are actually the people that they are. But I think the concern arises from the kind of upstream question of thresholds and lowering the threshold by transferring a technology and seeing how in the hands of all these other countries, multiply that times the lower threshold that seems to have been the case in the United States, the result is a much more destabilized situation, even if the use of it may be more discriminate.
And can I add one small quick addendum to that, because you've asked such a good question, it's made me think more, is that one of the other threshold issues is not just the use of force, but again, it's use of force over other options. And the U.S. has claimed since 2011 that it has a demonstrated, quote, preference for capturing suspected terrorists over killing them. And the reason is, as you all know, in the military community, the whole point is to increase your situational awareness of the environment where these groups operate. It's the acronym is the find, fix, finish, exploit, analyze, disseminate. And when you do drone strikes, all you do is find, fix, finish, right? You don't get intelligence to exploit, to analyze, and disseminate. And since the Obama administration claims that it has a preference to capture versus kill, it has done 4 capture missions and over 202, because I updated it this morning, 202 drone strikes. And, I mean, I spend quite a bit of time with people in the special operators world and people on special mission units all over the world, and they will tell you they would be more than happy to go into these countries at greater risk to themselves and to the mission to capture individuals if the White House determined that they wanted them to do that. But, in fact, because you have the drone, you are less likely to attempt those slightly riskier capture missions. So even though we claim we have a preference for capturing or killing, the evidence is very clear, 400 to 202, that it's not true.
Thank you. Next question.
Thank you again. If you would like to ask a question, please press star 1. Our next question comes from Northeastern University.
Thank you very much for speaking with us. Obviously, there are numerous problems with drones, but since technology is developing very fast now, there is also a potential threat of development of lethal autonomous weapon systems, so-called killer robots with no man on loop. So my question is, how concerned should we be about the development of these weapons? We know that already there is a campaign to stop killer robots, and there is already an international committee for robot arms control. So obviously, potentials for their development are pretty strong. Thank you.
I'll just take that one briefly. You know, you're correct that there is a campaign to stop killer robots, but there's really not much evidence of a campaign to start killer robots. I understand that this is a tremendous concern for a lot of people because the prospect of fully autonomous lethal systems using force is worrisome, but there's really not much evidence for this existing. People sort of make this claim that there's this inevitability of this capability being out there, but one thing to understand is that there is autonomy already built into lots of things that we use, both in terms of sensors and algorithms on the battlefield. For example, the U.S. drones that drop bombs in Pakistan, they take off from air bases in Afghanistan, and then they're just left to go fly on their own until they reach a GPS-designated point, and then they're picked back up by satellite communications people in San Antonio and Las Vegas and elsewhere. So there's actually some degree of autonomy in them already. Obviously, there are other autonomous systems like the Phalanx anti-missile naval platform that has autonomy in terms of identifying cruise missile and low trajectory signatures and returning fire. But it's important to understand that it is U.S. policy not to have fully autonomous lethal capabilities. There is a Department of Defense instructions. You can find it on the web. It's pretty clearly articulated. Now, that does not mean that there are not individuals pursuing this and that there are not some countries who are looking to add additional degrees of autonomy. But the primary reason they're doing this is because one of the myths of drones is that they're less costly than manned platforms. A Predator or Reaper takes about 160 people on the ground to maintain one in the air for 24 hours. That's to watch video screens, as Sarah mentioned. That's to refit and refuel them, et cetera. And so anything that you can do to get humans out of that 160 number, to bring that 160 number down, is what they're really focused on doing because humans are the most expensive thing in the Department of Defense budget. So I think the bigger concern is to correctly bring attention to this and have a much more fully developed conversation about what we mean when we talk about autonomy, because, again, it's not an either-or thing.
Thank you. Next question.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Washington and Lee University.
So much for joining us today. My question was, how many of the 500 drone strikes that you mentioned outside of combat have failed? And can you give us ballpark numbers for the number of innocent civilians that have been killed?
Sure, but I'll just say the easiest answer for you is just Google America's 500th drone strike, because we did a long blog post on this last week. But the estimates, and the estimates that we use are based upon the New America Foundation, the Bureau of Investigative Journalism, and Long War Journal. These are three independent research organizations that monitor reports of drone strikes. And of the 500 drone strikes, 13% of them and then something like 3,680 people were killed. Of those, 473 are estimated to be civilians. So that's 13% of what are estimated to be the total number of individuals killed in non-battlefield settings by drones were killed, are collateral damage. That's the estimates they make. And by the way, they say that these estimates are roughly accurate. So this is not some far out there radical estimate. It's not necessarily a conservative estimate. This is the best publicly available data we have.
Sarah, do you have anything to add, or shall we move on to the next question?
No, I would just urge that everyone take a look at that blog post, because it I think captures very nicely by country and by year the total numbers, and then the estimated percentage of civilians killed, because I think that really gets at what the question was addressing.
Great. Let's move on to the next question.
Thank you. Again, if you would like to ask a question, please press star and the number one. And our next question comes from the University of Pennsylvania.
Hi, thank you so much. I found that blog post incredibly insightful. My question is, what happens if the technology becomes so cheap and plentiful that we, including big players besides the U.S., are then forced to think about a new way of understanding how to use this technology appropriately? Would you say that the trajectory it would take would be similar to the trajectory cars have taken since their inception? And what do you think the implications are?
I wonder if you could clarify a little bit what you mean by, or what you have in mind when you say the technology becomes so cheap and plentiful. Are you thinking about nano drones, or what do you have in mind?
Essentially, what I'm saying is drones today are rather expensive, especially those that have to be able to carry a payload for military operations. As a civilian now, I have access to a $3,000 commercial drone, which couldn't do anything as far as any strike is concerned. But initially, cars were rather expensive in their inception. But over time, and a few individual industrialists really pushing for it, cars have become so plentiful that it's become almost a social trope in the U.S. that, you know, when you turn a certain age, you get a ride. So that's led to a plethora of laws, a subsystem of courts, all regarding just traffic alone, so that we can use this new dangerous technology safely and trust one another to use it. And so I ask you, what do you think the implications are if this is true of drones?
So my take on this is that this is much more of the picture you're painting is much more likely to be an issue domestically and in some ways commercially than it is in terms of the armed drones that we have been talking about. It's not to say that that's not an important issue. In fact, I think it is, and I think it's one that the FAA is really struggling with. I was at the University of Pennsylvania. Sure.
What I'm trying to get at is simply, if we have to come up with a new way of thinking how to use this technology safely, even if it's just at home, would we not then be forced? Would it not be incumbent upon us, if not morally, then just pragmatically, to think about our drone use abroad in a different way at that point? Establishing different ideas of what's acceptable.
Micah, do you want to
Well, I think, I mean, just to hit the point that Sarah made earlier, is that states watch how other capability, how other states use military capabilities, right? There's a tremendous amount of intelligence gathering, open source, learning. States want to know how to integrate a new form of lethality or surveillance into their military doctrine. Non-state actors do this as well. I mean, terrorists watch how states, how other non-state actors use, and there's a lot of mimicry, both on offensive and defensive systems. There's the offense-defense balance never ends. Certainly, drones will only get, A, cheaper, more plentiful. They'll become more lethal. They'll be able to loiter longer. They'll require less fuel. They'll be more autonomous. That is undeniable because it's sort of the classic Moore's laws of microchip processing that will happen. I think that's not going to happen as fast as you, as most people think, as we should worry about. But I think you're absolutely right that the worry that others will have this capability and be able to do things with them that we can't foresee today should make it more of a pressing concern for the U.S. to think about the norms and precedents they're establishing. And by the way, President Obama and all the senior aides have said that the U.S. is setting norms for how other states will use armed drones in the future. The problem is that the degree of a transparency and accountability with how they use this capability has been pretty limited to date, certainly much more open and transparent and accountable than the Bush administration was. But again, of the 500 drone strikes I mentioned earlier, 450 occurred under Obama and only 50 occurred under Bush, so there's more of an obligation of this current administration to do so. But it's certainly a concern because this technology will proliferate, it will become cheaper, easier, whether it's a status symbol or not. That's also, by the way, why states develop military capabilities for simply prestige reasons. They're not necessarily destabilizing or damaging, but that's certainly a concern and one that this administration should take into account.
Thank you. Let's see if we can get one more question in.
Thank you. Our final question will come from the University of Washington.
Hi, I'm Frederick Lorenz at the University of Washington in Seattle. I'd just like to question this, the concept of customary law, which you just brought up, and the question of the U.S. perhaps setting norms here. In view of the United States' dominance of this field and the technology, and probably for the foreseeable future, are including the preference for capture and kill, the even the right to intervene, are we in a situation where essentially the U.S. Can develop its own norm, its own standard, and further, is a country like Turkey going to follow that?
It's a great question, and I think this is part of the concern that gets raised. It's interesting. It kind of builds on what Micah was just saying individuals who are in government, who come out of government, and then talk about this issue, whether it's Gates or Panetta or Hayden. And they all say the same thing, which is that we weren't careful enough about the precedent that we were setting. And the U.S. could, again, kind of in a realist world, decide that might makes right and it's so powerful and dominant that it doesn't have to, that it can set its own rules. But I think that what you see in all of these, the Gates, Panetta, Hayden kinds of commentaries after they leave government and sometimes while they're in government, is that it has to be prepared to live by the consequences of that. And I think that's where it is. So Panetta says that to use drones too much, too often, or without careful consideration is to invite the world's condemnation, and I think it's also to invite the world's emulation. And I think it does that with at its peril.
Micah, would you like to make final remarks?
No, I would just
in response to that question.
Yeah, I mean, I think that was the sort of point to end on. I mean, the U.S. has a particular obligation to think about how this capability proliferates because it's the first user. The myth is that all states develop military capabilities at roughly. I mean, all states will sort of rush towards developing military capabilities and then will use them. But in fact, we find that lots of states. Don't. And I always point out the examples of the U.S., for example, doesn't use blinding lasers. Blinding lasers would actually be a pretty good thing to have at against certain adversaries. We decide not to use them. We say they're morally unjust. And there's a reciprocity that we don't want states using them against us. trying to get out of the landmine business, except for the carve-out of the DMZ as well, and even the landmines we use have changed radically just in the last 10 to 12 years. So states are shaped by norms and precedents, undoubtedly. And so thinking seriously about how the U.S. will do this, I think, is useful. And Sarah's right that when leaders leave office, they often say some really fascinating things about how the U.S. should use drones. After they leave, they say, we need to really think carefully about this. But it's not clear that really careful thinking is occurring when they're in office. And when other states use this, what will be our response? As I always tell, I tell the State Department, I tell the Pentagon, how do you want the Chinese Ministry of Foreign Affairs to articulate its first armed drone strike in Burma or against a Japanese contested atoll somewhere in the East China Sea? Because that's how we should be describing, defending, and justifying our use. But we're not quite there yet.
Well, Dr. Zenko and Dr. Krebs, thank you very much for today's call, for sharing your insights with us and your work on drones. We appreciate it. And to all of you for your excellent questions. Again, I encourage you all to take a look at the blog that Dr. Zenko writes, Politics, Power, and Preventive Action, and follow him on Twitter at Micah Zenko. This concludes our Fall 2014 Academic Conference Call Series for the semester. Good luck with your finals, and we hope you have a really great holiday. Our next call will be in late January, early February. We will be sending the schedule out in the next week or so please look for that. In the meantime, I encourage you to follow CFR's Academic Outreach Initiative on Twitter at CFR_academic for information on new CFR resources and upcoming events. So again, thank you all for your participation. Good luck on your exams and have a wonderful break.
Thank you for listening to this Council on Foreign Relations podcast. For additional audio, video, and transcripts of CFR meetings, as well as expert analysis of international news, please visit us online, cfr.org.